From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's on assignment. On this edition of Fresh Air, conversing with the planets. It's the 25th anniversary of the moonwalk, and a comet is pelting Jupiter. Today, we use the highest tech equipment to look at the results of the comet crash, but stargazing has held people captive for thousands of years. We'll talk with Anthony Avini, an astronomer who's also an anthropologist. And we'll talk to filmmaker Ang Lee. Lee's new movie, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, explores what happens when old world Chinese traditions clash with new world sensibilities. Also, Spike Jonze is back. Our usually classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two Spike Jonze collections which have just been reissued. All that coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan is warning that interest rates may need to go higher. The Fed chief told members of a Senate panel today it is not clear if past interest rate hikes are enough to keep inflation in check. He says he's determined to quash any inflationary surge. He also says he's seeing signs the economy is running into a kind of bottleneck. Greenspan says this bottleneck often comes just before higher inflation, and the central bank needs to be alert to this. The White House has released a new report in support of its demand for universal health care coverage. It finds that most uninsured Americans are middle-income workers. UPI's Bill Small reports.
The administration released a survey which it said showed that most Americans without health insurance are not unemployed, disabled, elderly, or poor. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Benson says almost a quarter of them are children, and 84% of them are in working families.
Most uninsured either have an employer who doesn't have or doesn't provide coverage, or the worker can't afford to buy it without help. And for most of the uninsured, being without insurance, it's a long-term, not a short-term problem.
Benson says that makes an effective argument for requiring employers to chip in for their employees' health care coverage. Bill Small at the White House.
A U.S. congressman just back from Haiti says it would be a mistake for the United States to invade now. New Mexico Democrat Bill Richardson says invasion should be a last resort. He says Haiti's military rulers aren't opposed to compromise. Richardson briefed President Clinton and congressional leaders today on his meeting Monday with Haiti's military rulers. The Bosnian Serbs have responded ambiguously to an international peace plan aimed at ending the Bosnian War. Officials from the U.S., Russia, and Western Europe had insisted the Serbs give a clear yes or no to the plan. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Bosnian Serb leaders arrived in Geneva today carrying a sealed envelope which contained their parliament's verdict on the peace plan. According to diplomatic sources quoted by wire services, the Serbs told the international mediators they want to accept the proposal but do not have enough information on which to base their response. They also expressed their desire to withdraw their captured lands from Bosnia, which the plan does not allow. In short, the Serbs said yes, provided they can continue to negotiate. The mediators will now have to decide whether that's good enough or whether they should take the response as a no and proceed with sanctions against the Serbs. That question has the potential to split Russia and the U.S., who until now have shown unusual solidarity in their approach to the problem. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 15 points to 3,733. Trading is very heavy. 260 million shares have changed hands. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is down 8 at 7.11. This is NPR. The Israeli embassy in Panama says most of the 19 passengers aboard a plane that crashed on its way to Panama City yesterday were Jewish. There are some fears in the local Jewish community that sabotage brought down the plane. The embassy says 12 of the victims were Jewish and 4 of them were Israelis. Witnesses say they saw the twin-engine commuter plane explode as it flew in heavy rain. But Panamanian investigators and the Israeli embassy say they're waiting for more details on the crash. Political protests in Nigeria against the ruling military government continue on the eve of a visit from an American special envoy. NPR Suni Khalid reports from the White House.
President Clinton is sending the Reverend Jesse Jackson as his special one-time envoy for talks this week with Nigeria's military ruler, General Sani Abacha. Administration officials said that Jackson will deliver a message to Abacha on the need to resume progress toward democratization, releasing political detainees, and resuming counter-narcotics cooperation. Jackson is also scheduled to meet with various Nigerian political, human rights, and labor leaders during his three-day visit. Jackson will also try to meet with his longtime friend, Tycoon Masoud Abiola, the apparent winner of last year's presidential elections. The military annulled those results, and Abacha seized power last fall. Last month, Abiola declared himself president and was quickly arrested for treason. Since then, pro-democracy forces have staged wide-scale labor strikes and protests against Nigeria's military rulers that have paralyzed much of the country. I'm Suni Khalid at the White House.
Celebrity Cruises says investigators have found evidence of the bacterium that causes Legionnaire's disease on one of its ships. The company says the Centers for Disease Control conducted tests over the weekend after several passengers got sick with the illness. The ship's water system was then cleaned. Legionnaire's disease is a rare form of bacterial pneumonia. Some cases of this can be fatal. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Jupiter is taking a beating this week from comet fragments that are crashing onto the face of the planet. These collisions are so large that the marks they leave on Jupiter are visible even to amateur astronomers through their backyard telescopes. Anthony Avini says that human beings have been gazing upwards for thousands of years, looking for answers to questions about the relationship between the cosmos and human behavior. Avini is an archaeoastronomer who's been studying ancient cultures, particularly the Mayans, and how they came to understand the movements of the planets. His book, Conversing with the Planets, is about how early societies, through naked-eye observations, discovered many of the secrets of the universe, and how some of those discoveries help scientists today. Anthony Avini is a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University. He says the comet crash of this week would be meaningful to cultures thousands of years ago, though for different reasons.
There is a lot of excitement about the comet crashing into Jupiter. There used to be a lot of excitement when comets came into the sky hundreds and thousands of years ago and were first seen by ancient people. Comets were omens. They usually were bad, spelled with four B's and four D's, very bad. It's interesting that under the surface of all the comet hype that's going on this week, there is a negative omen, isn't there? Namely, what if it should strike the Earth?
Right.
What if something like this should take place on the Earth? And I think we're just as eager in anticipation of something happening to us as a result of some phenomenon we see in the sky. So in that sense, there's a parallel. Of course, there are differences.
Well, let's talk a little about the fact that it seemed that the people of many years ago, and you've written about the Mayas and the Babylonians and others of that time, that they looked at the sky because they saw significance there. And I wonder if that isn't something that's different today. We don't look to the sky so much to try to understand what nature is all about.
The difference between us and them, I think, Marty, is that they used the sky for practical purposes. They used it to devise a calendar. How is our calendar made up? Well, it's made of months that are pages, 12 pages to a sheet, weeks, and of course days, which are the most obvious regular periodic occurrence. Ancient people watched the phases of the moon to determine the month. They didn't mark, peel off pages of a calendar. Likely, the women in that society used the moon to regulate the menstrual cycle. In fact, there is an obvious connection between the two through evolution. When we come to things like periodic comets and eclipses, which are the really fantastic events, well, they too, many of them can be predicted. And the Maya, for example, wrote a very famous book known as the Dresden Codex, because it turned up in the library in Dresden, Germany, after the Spaniards ripped it off from the natives, which has an eclipse table accurate to the day. And you can still use it to predict eclipses. So the sky was a permanent part of their practical environment. I mean, they used the sky the way you use a computer or a PC.
And you say the Mayas were the cleverest astronomers in the Americas.
Well, I mean, I'm for them, but I think a Babylonianist would argue to the contrary. In Conversing with the Planets, I have a chapter where I talk about one of the cuneiform tablets of the Babylonians, and I compare it with a Maya book with the calendar of Venus that they follow. They seem to be quite fascinated with the planet Venus. They followed it all around the sky. And these two documents, the Babylonian tablet and the Maya book, are almost identical in their prediction. So I think, yes, these New World astronomers were right up there with the Greeks and the Romans and all those guys who gave us our culture, I think.
You said most of the early stargazers watched the horizon. Why?
Well, our astronomers, of course, look up, don't they? And right. We look up with our telescopes probably because it's clearer there. The atmosphere is less hazy. But the horizon line provided a line of demarcation. It pretty much told where objects appeared and disappeared. And the Maya were very concerned about that, about where things came up, where they went down, sacred directions. All over ancient Yucatan, the Mayas aligned a number of their religious buildings with the places where their gods and planetary gods would appear and disappear. And this whole cosmic architecture was a part of their realm. So the horizon is a dividing line between the world below and the world above.
Did the early astronomers use any kinds of instruments?
Well, this is the famous question. Of course, we being so technologically oriented, will say, how could they do it? How could
right.
they predict the appearance of Venus to a day, to within a day in 500 years? There is no evidence, Marty, in the archaeological record that they used anything. And that does baffle me. I wish we would dig up some sticks or notch sticks or rulers or something. Apparently, they did it all with either no tech or low tech, and we have to let the archaeological record speak for them here, because if we don't find the evidence that they were using such tools, why, we have to be prepared to devise their science and explain it without them.
I'm curious, and you mentioned the fact that Venus seemed to hold a special place in some of the early cultures. Why Venus, you think?
Well, when we're kids, of course, we all memorize the planets, don't we? Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. And we're taught that they're all little tiny round balls that go around the sun. Some, like Jupiter, bigger than others. If you look at the way they behave in the sky, however, they don't all do the same thing. Venus, in particular, always lays very close to the sun. It rises ahead of the sun, portending the arrival of the sun god on Earth. It departs shortly after the sun. You might almost say it rises like a phoenix out of the ashes, if you want to get poetic about it, of the sun. Well, Venus was, for the Maya, the brother of the sun. He was the brother of the sun god who announced his appearance. In the old world, she, a female, was Ishtar, the love goddess, because she descended into the underworld to follow her lover who had been captured by the underworld gods. And then she came back garbed in all of her seven veils. So Venus does something that the other planets don't do. If you follow Jupiter, for example, Jupiter ranges all the way around the sky at night. You can see it high in the midnight sky opposite the sun. Not so Venus. Wherever the sun is, Venus will always be close behind. I think this is interesting because it suggests to us that there are different classifications of nature, different taxonomies, to use a science word, that other cultures might see that we don't. They might slice up the natural world different from us. Apples and oranges might be in the same basket in their world.
Did some of these ancient cultures divide plants into male and female? Venus, of course, having some female attributes. Jupiter, of course, as we understand it today, having more male attributes, whatever that is.
Well, Marty, they were sexists. I mean, these people were sexists. And I've got some passages in Conversing written by the priests and the people, the astrologers. And I have to put the little disclaimer in there that, hey, you know, I didn't write this, guys. This is written by those people. Venus is the only prominent female planetary deity. The others are male, as you might expect, the god of war, the god of justice and equality, Jupiter, the god of the underworld, Saturn, and so on. And I think that this is largely history written by men, and you don't get a lot of women in it. Of course, there's Athena. She may show up as an asteroid, but not as a prominent planet.
Why, though, has Venus been associated with love and fertility?
Well, that's a complex question, and a lot of people have written on it. Pliny, the Roman writer, says that Venus causes the dew on the grass. Now, that's a good reason to see Venus causing the dew, because Venus is always close to the earth, isn't it? Close to the sun after sunset. When the sun goes down, you get dew on the grass. And then when animals rub their genitals over the dew, that's what causes the whole fertility reaction to take place. I think this is kind of a neat, if superstitious, scientific explanation of how Venus, of all things, is connected with fertility. But we have to remember that the relationships between things in nature in the mind of a Roman or a Greek or a Mayan or a Babylonian is just not the same as it is in ours. So there's one reason for Venus being a love deity.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Jupiter, since we're all obsessed with that planet, with all the goings-on up there with the comet crash. What were some of the early beliefs about what Jupiter was all about?
Well, Jupiter has always been one of those kind of middle-of-the-road planets. I mean, it's not the farthest from the sun, and it's not the nearest. It's not the brightest, and it's not the faintest. And in the Greco-Babylonian world, that's why they thought that Jupiter was the god of mediation and justice, because he takes the just and middle position. And that's the appropriate position to be taken by the king of the gods, isn't it? Not the queen, the king. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to be the king of the gods, you've got to be fair and just. You've got to look out after the little guy, and you've got to make sure the big guy doesn't get too out of place. And so Jupiter has that mediatory aspect. Now, in the Maya world, it's interesting that none of these aspects appear. None of these things having to do with connotations having to do with justice appear. There was a king of the ruins of Palenque. I say ruins because the city's been destroyed for 1,500 years, who followed the planet Jupiter and demarcated all the events in his life after the movement of that planet. Nobody knows why. He is said to have been married, to have conceived his children, to have acceded to office, even to have died when Jupiter did something in the sky. Now, of course, I think that's probably history. Revisionist history, because I don't think you can plan your death to coincide, or birth or death to coincide with Jupiter.
Anthony Avini is our guest on Fresh Air today. He's a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University and author of a book called Conversing with the Planets, How Science and Myth Invented the Cosmos. What was it about planets and planet behavior, you think, that inspired some of these early cultures to create stories? And we were talking earlier about the kind of predictability of nature and looking to nature to understand the future, to understand the present and the past. But it seems that planets also were the seeds that many stories and myths came out of.
Well, Marty, if you look at the sky, of course, you'll see the stars ever present. Scorpio will always be Scorpio. The Big Dipper is always shaped like a dipper, at least for thousands and thousands of years. And the sun will always rise in the east and set in the west, although it'll shift its motion a little bit. The planets do something quite different. They wander. Mm. And in fact, the word planet means wanderer. And there's a debate about the etymology of that word. If you go into detail, some of the Babylonians contend that it means the sheep who escaped from the fold. Well, anything that wanders around the sky on a journey, of course, can be the subject of a marvelous travel myth like the Odyssey or the Iliad. And so these wanderers then who wandered across the sky became counterparts of terrestrial people, the deities. And of course, the gods behave very much the way you and I do. Mm. Some of them were fickle, some of them were strong, some weak, some jealous. And I think then humanity projected all of its doings, all of its wanderings and goings-on, on the sky. The planets travel the zodiacal roadway. They move across the track of 12 constellations, Cancer the Crab, Taurus the Bull, and so on. And as they move from one house to another, perhaps they portend good and bad. When they go from the house of fortune to the house of love, maybe we'll lose all our bucks and fall madly in love. And I think they're wonderful backgrounds, stages, sets, if you want, for enacting stories, for telling fairy tales.
Well, were there all sorts of ceremonies then where we'll say, Mayans or Babylonians or others would come out and watch certain events in the sky?
Well, they would, because the old astrologer's motto is as above, so below. And I think that that means, of course, that whatever happens in nature or in the sky also happens with us here on Earth, and that's the motto of astrology. This is something, a belief that was adhered to all over the world, still is in many parts of the world, and it can be even argued that in newspaper astrology today, people still believe that. I think we waste our time going around condemning it as scientists and saying, no, this is the truth. I think the truth shall be what the people want it to be, and much of it may be wishful thinking, but these stories are wonderful and beautiful. And so it's logical that these stories would be tied to religion, because if you can influence those gods, cajole them, bribe them, con them a little bit by making an offering, why, maybe they would do you a good turn. Maybe the comet wouldn't cause death and deprivation.
Are there certain given scientific principles that we understand today, principles like gravity, that have their roots or their understandings back in some of these early civilizations?
Well, you don't have to have gravity to function and to live in the world, and there are other ways of explaining how things happen. I think a Maya person, if that person could come back, Maya people aren't dead in the first place, they're still alive, but I mean, if an ancient Maya astronomer could come here into the studio and talk with us, he'd probably say something like, well, I don't really give a damn what the center of the universe is. I'm the center of the universe. My culture is the center of the universe. And whether there are these orbits that define what goes around what in some mathematical system is of no consequence to me. Any more consequence than there is a comet falling into Jupiter or there's a spiral galaxy catapulting away from us at hundreds of miles per second. So what? And I think the old flat earthers say, the people who believe in the flat earth, is that as far as I'm concerned, the earth is flat and it doesn't have any impact on my life. Well, we tend to regard that as a kind of narrow-minded statement. But then we have to realize that these other people had different ways of compartmentalizing their knowledge. So gravity, in my mind, becomes kind of irrelevant. Uh-huh. I don't know if I'm making that point well enough for you to get across here, but I think gravity doesn't have to be a part of the picture. You can still live on Earth and function and explain things very well without it.
How many flat earthers are there in the world?
Oh, heavens, I don't know. I'm certainly not a member. I want you to know that.
Well, I understand that, but...
Not so many. I understand they had a society based in England, and I remember that when the Apollo moon landing took place, they denied that it ever happened. And of course, the flat earthers pretty much stuck to that. But I don't know. Not a large membership, I don't think. Well, they'll probably get calls now.
Well, let's just take a short break. And again, our guest today on Fresh Air is Anthony Avini, and he's a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University. He's the author of a book called Conversing with the Planets, How Science and Myth Invented the Cosmos. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is archaeoastronomer Anthony Avini. Well, I don't want to give the moon short shrift this week because, of course, this is the week that we celebrate the 25th anniversary of the first moonwalk. And I would think that for many cultures that the moon has to have a very central place. Obviously, it's very changeable. Its size in the sky, of course, is bigger than anything else in the night sky. What are some of the early beliefs, ideas about what the moon was all about?
The moon, I think, was one of the most important objects in the sky in devising ancient calendars. And it's a short period, that moon phase cycle, isn't it? You go from new to quarter to full and then back again in a month, 29 days. In fact, the moon calendar, reckoning by months rather than years, was in vogue all over the world really up to the time of Julius Caesar. It's Julius Caesar who gave us the solar-based calendar of 12 months in a year. It isn't surprising that short duration period would govern time because isn't it easier to say, well, I'll meet you in a quarter moon from now or one moon from now rather than 0.67 of a year or a certain number of months. There, of course, is the myth of the man in the moon, which is a marvelous myth about the age-old story of the rise to power and the cataclysmic decline. What happens to that man in the moon who we've seen in profile looking like a face on a cameo? You see his curly locks of hair and a medallion around his neck. He's bitten by a dragon who gradually eats him away, and he dies. But, of course, when he dies, he's replaced by his son, who is the new moon, who gradually grows and waxes to brilliant incandescence. But then, just like any great hero, American or otherwise, in the height of his power, he falls and is bitten by the same nemesis who did his dad in. Well, that's a marvelous myth, and it goes all the way around the world. And there are the male and female connotations, of course. Male sun, female moon, and all of the dualities, polarities, complementarities, as the anthropologist would say, in life between men and women are reflected in sun and moon myths.
Let me ask you about what this week has been like for you as scientists and lay people are learning about and watching some of the comet crashes on Jupiter. What's it been like for you?
Well, we have talked about it a lot because it's a big event. To me, it's parallel to the Ranger camera crashing into the moon back in the early 60s, the landing on the moon, all of those marvelous space missions with new imagery. It's only really been in my lifetime and my extent of teaching for some 30 years that all of these things have happened. And it's very, very exciting to see. I think what I reflect on most of all is the kind of impact frenzy we're involved with lately. Catastrophic things that take place. The newspapers talking about the astronomers gleefully watching this impact. Well, I think not because they like bombs and impacts, but because it's exciting. Everybody mm-hmm. loves a big bang. In our generation, I think we've been through a lot of cataclysmic ideas in science that have taken place. Look at the genetic alteration of a tomato, for example. With the snap of a finger, you can suddenly change a species. Punctuated equilibrium in evolution. The stories of whole civilizations that can be wiped out by tidal waves and volcanic eruptions. We're a very catastrophe-oriented generation, aren't we? And here comes another great catastrophe. Thank goodness it's not happening to us. And I think that's the real bottom line of all of this. What would happen if it did happen to us? And in that sense, the comet is very much an omen, just the way it was for the ancient Mayas or for the ancient Babylonians.
Let me ask you a personal question about your interest in, I guess, this mix of archaeology or anthropology and astronomy. When did you get interested in astronomy?
Well, it's I'd been teaching at Colgate for a few years, started there very young. And one day some of my students said to me, you know, what we should do, Professor, is to go to Mexico because there are all these Mexican ruins and there's a lot of astronomy going on there and so on. Well, this was back in the days of the Stonehenge controversy mm-hmm. in the 60s, which you may have heard of, that Britain's monument, which was alleged to be an observatory, and there was a lot of controversy about it. And we'd been teaching a January studies term there, one of those one-month terms where a dozen students do one thing with the professor. I don't have to tell you that teaching in the confines of central New York, upstate New York, it's very cold in the winter.
So Mexico sounded very good.
As I put it, escape the vagaries of the New York climate. To make a short story long, we went to Mexico. I took a study group to Mexico. We just fell into a situation wherein we found material that hadn't been studied. Nobody had really looked at Mexican pyramids and the idea that they might be oriented to the sun, the moon, and the planets and the stars. Nobody had really been carrying on extensive studies of Mesoamerican astronomy. And so we did it. We started doing it, and as we did it, we helped develop the field of archaeoastronomy. We taught courses. We wrote books. And my students have always been a part of my work, and they still are. We're still running the program 32 years later in Mexico.
So you weren't the neighborhood kid who had the telescope in his backyard and the
binoculars
around his neck?
Well, I was as a kid. I was one of these six-year-old kids who always wanted to be an astronomer, and it was before the days of astronauts. I was that type of kid, but my goal was to study astronomy, which I did. I studied in Arizona, University of Arizona, Kitt Peak, came to Colgate, bought the telescope and did all of that. And then all of a sudden I changed my life by getting interested in the ancient stuff. Hmm. So what I'm really doing now is not so much studying the stars as studying the people who studied stars and I guess discovering they're not so different.
Well, thank you very much, Anthony Avini, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Anthony Avini is a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University and the author of Conversing with the Planets. I'm Artie Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowen with Fresh Air. Coming up, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Filmmaker Ang Lee says food and sex are the two most important things in life. His new film about Taiwan's leading chef is the last in a trilogy exploring what happens when Chinese traditions mix with contemporary society. His previous movie was the low-budget hit The Wedding Banquet. And our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz veers off his usual beat to take a look at another kind of classic, the music of Spike Jones. His work has just been reissued on two CDs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Relief workers in refugee camps along the Rwandan-Zairean border say the situation there is rapidly deteriorating. They say cholera has begun to strike the refugees, and dozens of cases could become hundreds tomorrow. NPR's Michael Scholar is at the border camp in Goma, Zaire. He says he's seen dozens of people who've lost their families to the drastic refugee conditions.
I ran into a teenager by the side of the road who was crying. I went to talk to him. He was lying there with his mother, who seemed very, very sick, and he told me that they had lost the father in the last few days in this mass exodus of refugees, and that now he thought his mother was going to die because she could no longer walk, and she was just by the side of the road. He said they hadn't eaten in days, and there are many, many people, families like that along the roads here.
Relief officials have completed the first mass burial of refugees today. Bodies filled a long grave at the edge of a plantation on the road to the Goma airport. Witnesses say at least 200 bodies were buried. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has begun talks in Jordan with Israeli and Jordanian officials. Christopher says next week's meeting in Washington between Jordan's King Hussein and Israel's Prime Minister Rabin will transform the Middle East. The BBC's Chris Morris reports.
In the opening ceremony, all three men spoke of an historic moment for the Middle East. Mr. Peres said it had taken his delegation 15 minutes to travel here, but 46 years to arrive. Warren Christopher said the responsibility of all the participants was clear.
To join together in making for this great holy land a new era of peace and hope. A peace that is enduring because it is comprehensive. A peace not just of treaties, but of commerce and human exchange.
Beyond the rhetoric, all three countries know that there's much hard work to be done. This is the fifth meeting of the Trilateral Commission, but the first held in the Middle East. The participants are trying to negotiate the details of prospective economic and cultural agreements, which will promote closer long-term relations and deliver tangible benefits to the people of the region.
The BBC's Chris Morris reporting. Police in Buenos Aires, Argentina, have pulled three more bodies out of the rubble of a building that was blown up this week. At least 32 people are known dead from the explosion in the seven-story structure. At least 127 other people have been hurt. Several Jewish organizations were housed in the building. A rescue crew spokesman says workers can't hear voices anymore under the wreckage, but they are still looking. Officials from Argentina's president on down are saying the blast was planned from abroad. Israel is blaming Muslim fundamentalists supported by Iran. Iran has denied the charge. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 21 points today to end at 3,727. This is NPR. Senior congressional Democrats say President Clinton is being misunderstood about his recent remarks on health care. Yesterday, Mr. Clinton seemed to imply that he could accept health care reform without universal coverage. The president says he was misunderstood and he wants every American covered. But he acknowledges that some people will always slip through health care cracks. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell says the president is just being realistic. House Speaker Tom Foley says Mr. Clinton has been unfairly criticized for changing his position, even though that hasn't happened. A new government survey shows that a 13-year decline in the number of illegal drug users has leveled off. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The National Household Survey on Drug Abuse is a yearly census of illegal drug use based on questionnaires filled out by thousands of Americans. The latest findings for 1993 show that 11.7 million people were current users of drugs like cocaine or marijuana. That's about the same number as the year before, and marks the end of a decline in drug use that began in 1979. Surveyors say the decline was mostly among casual users. Some drug use is increasing, marijuana among young people, for example, and the number of once-a-week cocaine users has remained steady since 1985. Donna Shalala, head of the Department of Health and Human Services, says new treatment efforts should focus more on chronic drug takers. She says the survey also found that one of two teenagers does not view experimenting with drugs as risky. I'm Christopher Joyce in Washington.
The government says mortgage rates are dampening the housing industry. The Commerce Department says housing starts dropped 9.8% last month. Activity was down in all regions of the nation except the Northeast. Analysts have linked the slowdown to the mortgage rates, too. They point out that mortgage rates have stayed above 8% since April. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Don't go see Ang Lee's new film, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, on an empty stomach. The opening sequence alone will make your tummy growl. Master Chef Tao Chu is preparing a lavish meal for his three adult daughters. He carefully and knowingly slices each ingredient, cooks them with a flick of the wrist, and like magic, creates a mouth-watering, multi-course feast. Problem is, his daughters could care less. They see these ritual meals as boring, meaningless, a waste of time. They want a break from family tradition. Their father wants to keep those traditions alive. Eat, Drink, Man, Woman continues Ang Lee's exploration of the tension between parent and child in a changing Taiwanese society. It's a theme he dealt with in his first two films, Pushing Hands and The Wedding Banquet, which won the Berlin Film Festival in 1993 and was nominated that same year for an Academy Award. Ang Lee grew up in Taiwan in a culture and family that prized food. When he came to the States to study theater and film, he started to cook for himself, his wife, and kids because he hated American food and was unemployed for so many years. Later, he found the cooking was a lot like making movies.
It's art. You have to foresee some taste or look. That's very similar to director, where everybody play as an ingredient. They work in one direction without knowing what's going to be like when they put together, except the director has a guess and foresee what's going to be like. That's like cooking. And then you prepare the ingredients and put them together with the right proportion. And then you care very much how people feel when they eat them.
Let me ask you about the actual filming of the food preparation. How many takes and retakes do you have to have for some of the preparation of some of these dishes? And maybe you could explain to us how you go about doing that.
Oh, that's one of the toughest part of this film making is the food. Especially those food that display in one big round table. Mm-hmm. Sometimes 9-10 takes, and there are about 10 big courses of dishes, and they all have to be steamy and look fresh, and the green has to look green, the red has to look red. It takes a lot of organizing to think about and to bring them up hot all at one time. And you have like one or two fresh minutes to film them. If the actor screw up a line, you want to kill them.
So
redo it all over again. It's very time consuming.
What was the most challenging dish to film?
Believe it or not, one of them is easy looking one. That slicing tofu.
Oh yeah.
That daughter slicing tofu. That took about 6 hours to film, to light.
Why?
You want to bring out the best out of that piece of tofu. It takes a lot of time to study, and you don't want it to look like commercial. And then it's a very skillful thing to slicing the tofu like a piece of paper. It takes a lot of takes. And when the piece of tofu diminish, like getting lower and lower, you have to get a new one. Start all over again.
Now, this is the first film that you've made in Taiwan. Your other two films were shot in the States. What was it like to go home to shoot a film?
A lot of pressure. It was the first homecoming project. I have to prove that I cannot only make movie in the States, that I can make a movie, especially after the wedding banquet with the Taiwanese crew in Taiwan and about Taipei, a place that I'm so familiar with, a place that I grew up with. So this is a lot of pressure. I was grudging all the time. And also it's different working philosophy behind production. Here it's the producer runs the show. As a director, you just do your artistic choices. And in Taipei, a director has to push every button. Everybody has a total loyalty to you. They don't move until you say so.
Which do you prefer?
I was hoping somewhere in between. But you know, I got a lot of more freedom in terms of time and budget, and it's more flexible shooting, and also more exhausting.
Let me ask you a little bit about your growing up in Taiwan. What kinds of movies did you enjoy as a kid?
Hollywood movies.
Such as?
Everything showing here, we see over there shortly after. And a lot of melodrama, Chinese melodrama, kung fu movies, comedies, things like that.
What were some of the Hollywood movies that you remember that you think might have even influenced you as a director?
I will have to say number one is Billy Wilder's Company, comedy. That has a big impact on me. So enjoyable.
Were you a movie-going kid? Did you used to go to the movies a lot?
Yes, a lot. We don't have other entertainment when I was a kid. Watching movie is the fantasy world. That's why the first time I came to the States, there's a strange feeling. This is like dreamland. I see the States from the movies. It's like walking into a movie set. That is has nothing to do with real life.
No.
Like, it's a fantasy land.
You found that out when you came here.
It's a make-believe, yeah, and I gradually find out what reality is.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first, let's just take a short break. And I'm speaking with Ang Lee, and his latest film is called Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, and it's about a family, a widower, and three daughters. His previous films include The Wedding Banquet and Pushing Hands. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is director Ang Lee. His latest film is called Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Your father was a high school principal, is that right? Was your mother also a teacher?
She's a teacher.
How important was academic achievement in your family?
Very important. That's the all important, is to be a useful man. See, my father's a high school principal, one of the best high school in Taiwan, and I was his student. But my mind is in movies all the time. I was a very absent-minded kid. So there's always a lot of pressure on me to study well and get into a good university.
Now, you failed your college entrance exam.
Right. That's how I got into the Academy of Art and into theater and movie later on.
Well, being that academic achievement was so important to your family, what effect did that have on them?
Well, I have to say it's a disgrace to the family. I got to look at the world from another angle. It's like fate that I belong to this the movie world.
When you say, though, disgrace to your family, what does that mean? And what did your parents say to you, and your father, I guess, in particular?
He didn't say much, but for the first time I see him cry in my life. It must be a big hit in the heart.
Well, you started in theater, is that right? And then went to film?
Yeah. Somehow I got an idea. Some great directors know theater. I don't know how I got that idea.
Maybe from Hollywood films?
I don't know, but anyway, when I was much younger, that's what I believe. So I started with theaters, did a lot of acting, then I came to the States, continued theatrical study. But by then, language was a big barrier for me, mm-hmm. because theater is talking head.
Sure.
And needs a lot of language ability. So I gradually shift my interest to directing. And later on, I find out stage is really for actors, and movie is the media for a director.
Now, you did script writing for a while. What was that like for you?
Oh, it's hell.
Hell? Really? In what way hell?
Well, I'm more of a director than writer. Yeah. I wrote because I wanted to direct, and I found that's the only way how I can break into the industry. It's a very competitive business. It's very hard unless you have something in your hand. You don't even have a bargain power to break into the business as a director. You don't work your way up. You jump in as a director, and you need a script. And from my peer, such as a schoolmate like Spike Lee, people like that, I see they get to start making movie because they're a good writer, not because at school they're good directors. So I just have to sit down and learn how to write feature-length script. And I have an agent. I have found that they are very hard on me when I have something they can pitch. So it's really narrowed down to writing. I have to be self-taught how to write feature-length script. And I did that for 6 years. Meanwhile, I was cooking and become a good cook and get obsessed about food making.
Now, you've written, or at least collaborated on some of the scripts for your own movies, is that right?
Yeah, I always do that. Either I write them myself or collaborate with a writer or some project attached to me as director, then I supervise the rewrite. So in one way or another, I stay very close to the development of a script.
Now, your first three films you've called a trilogy. They're Pushing Hands, The Wedding Banquet, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, your latest one. And all of them do seem to explore this parent-child relationship, children wanting to go their own way, afraid of hurting their parents in the process, trying to figure out how to reject tradition without rejecting their parents. Let's talk a little bit more about that, if we can. Do these movies, do they act for you as a way to try to, are you consciously and actively trying to resolve that for yourself through those movies?
You're like a therapy?
Well, I didn't want to go quite that far.
In a way, I guess. I wasn't really conscious about that until when I almost finished this last one, and I call it trilogy. I was aware that I was doing that. The first two movies just come out naturally because that's my first hand information, my life experience. I grew up in a steady and happily family, and then after school I formed my own family. And then, as I said, I spent many years just stay at home writing and cooking. So family has always been very close to me and my living environment. I know them best. So if I'm the writer, it's very easy for me to write something about it and also observe the change in the family, society, and about time, about many things like life attitude. It's just my closest material. And also it doesn't cost much money to make. Hmm. That's not a big reason.
Because
I write for me to direct. If I write 2,000 horses, a car crashes, people will pay me not to direct.
Not your style, right?
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, though, how you go about raising money for your films.
Well, it's strange. The money came to me. People pushed me to do those films. When I pursuing money, I never succeed. For those 6 years, I tried to raise money. I pitched stories, pitch scripts. It never happened. The first movie I did was because I entered a script competition in Taiwan and win the first prize. And the studio came to me and say, we know this script will lose money, but we want to do your first picture, so let's do it. I don't know if I can do a film with so little money in New York. I don't know what's going to happen. They said, no, go ahead, just try. That's how I started. And then that was a hit in Taiwan, the first picture. Then I got the money to do, just almost automatically, to do Wedding Banquet. I wrote Wedding Banquet 6 years ago. By then it was too Chinese to raise money here and too gay to raise money in Taiwan. But 5 years later, it was a hit picture. I don't know what to tell you. It's fate, I guess.
Do you plan to stay in the United States? You've made your first film in Taiwan. I don't know whether that gets you thinking about moving back to Taiwan or not.
Not yet. I'm happy to live here. The suburb, not in New York City.
Right.
The suburb, upstate New York. That's my idea of living, because you know, it's very peaceful, healthy, very middle class. Nobody bothers us. If I go to Taiwan, my family won't be living in peace. I don't think so. I try to get them away from film business as far as they can. So, you know, when I want to get crazy, I come to New York and work. And this is like the center of the world. I like New York, and I like the point of view of New York. Mm-hmm. It's like a United Nation of itself. I enjoy that, truly. I tend to think I'm a Chinese New Yorker type of filmmaker.
Well, Ang Lee, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Ang Lee's latest film, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, will open in the beginning of August. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. Today we have some anniversary items. This is the 25th anniversary of the moonwalk. We'll be hearing about that. It's also the 50th anniversary of the failed German plot to kill Adolf Hitler. And we'll be hearing about that from Deidre Berger in Germany. Also today, news of Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres visiting Jordan. That is the first time that an Israeli cabinet minister has gone to Jordan officially and been received officially there. And also news of the refugee crisis in Zaire, just across the border from Rwanda.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz loosens his tie, lets down his hair, and recommends two new Spike Jonze reissues. Lloyd says they're ideal summer listening, but if you need more serious reasons for enjoying these discs, you can find them too.
Oh, what delight to be given the right to be carefree and gay once again. No longer slinking, respectively drinking, like civilized ladies and men.
Have you ever thought that electronic music sounded like gunshots, sirens, or gurgles, gargles, burps, hiccups, and sneezes? Well, Spike Jonze and his City Slickers did it all first, and they did it without electronics.
In some secluded rendezvous that overlooks the avenue, with someone sharing a delight, chat, this and that, and cocktails for two, as we enjoy a cigarette to some exquisite chansonnette. Two hands are sure to slyly meet beneath a serviette with cocktails for two. My head may go really, but my heart will be obedient, with intoxicating kisses for the principal ingredient. Most any afternoon at 5, we'll be so glad we're both alive. Then maybe fortune will complete her plan that all began with cocktails for two.
Lindley Armstrong Jonze began recording for RCA in the summer of 1941 and became one of America's most popular stars. He satirized every kind of music, from hillbilly to Hawaiian. and contemporary subjects from knock-knock jokes to the Nazis. In Der Führer's Face, he gives Hitler a raspberry. Classical music is another favorite target. A highlight of the new Catalyst disc called Spiked is a 6-part send-up of the Nutcracker Suite. One of Jones's most popular recordings is his musical depreciation of Luigi Arditti's classic song Il Bacio, The Kiss. Ina Suez, the marvelous Donna Anna on the very first complete recording of Mozart's Don Giovanni in 1936, proves she's also a good sport. Sopranos beware. Here's Il Barchio. Other familiar voices include those of Mel Blanc, alias Bugs Bunny, and the tongue-twisted Doodles Weaver, brother of NBC TV president Sylvester Pat Weaver and uncle of Sigourney Weaver. No style goes undeconstructed. No pretension goes unpunctured. Also, few ethnic stereotypes or human impairments are ignored. Some of these 50-year-old jokes are not what you would call politically correct. But the comedy keeps its bite because the timing of the City Slickers is so sharp and their playing so brilliant. Many of the dated references are explained to a new generation in the richly detailed notes with great photos on Rhino Records' 2-disc Spike Jones anthology. No less distinguished a Jones fan than novelist Thomas Pynchon contributes a thoughtful essay for the Catalyst disc. If I count correctly, only 5 cuts overlap, which means that both sets are indispensable to anyone who loves music and likes to laugh.
Lloyd Schwartz is the Pulitzer Prize-winning classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the Spike Jones anthology on Rhino and Spiked on Catalyst. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowain.
Crush until the petals fall. You always break.
Crunch!
The kindest heart with a hasty word you can't recall.
Where are you, you old bat?
So if I broke.
Crunch!
Your heart last night, it's because I love you most of all.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, from Dracula to top secret weapons designer, we talk with Frank Langella, who portrays Dr. Gerald Bull in the HBO film Doomsday Gun, a true story set in the secret world of international arms dealing and espionage. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.